Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and that might just be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Very good, and excited about the program tonight.
I am so excited about our program this evening. You know, we've got a tremendous series going here, all summer long. The World Transformed, our 10-part introduction to all of the major transformations that we see coming. The topics that we've been talking about at The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio over the last, what are we coming up on, 6 years now for The Speculist? Is that right?
That's right.
Hard to imagine. It's been that long. Yeah, and probably, 5 years for Fast Forward Radio. So we've been doing this a while. We've been talking about these subjects for quite some time. And now we're taking a step back and we're taking some additional time all summer long. We've moved to Tuesday evenings. We've extended the length of our show. And we're saying, let's get into these topics. Last week we talked about what kind of mindset individuals need to start to adopt, how our thinking needs to change in order to be ready for a world that's in a state of transformation. This week we're going to talk about one of the key transformations, one of the most transformative, if that's a fair word to use for transformations, one of the biggest changes that could possibly happen to us as individuals or as a species, and that is the extension of human life. And we've dared to call this particular segment of Fast Forward Radio the age of the indefinite lifespan, entering the age of the indefinite lifespan. And I even put that that little kind of joke up there on the intro. I don't know if you saw that on The Speculist today, but where the guy goes into the doctor and says, "Give it to me straight, doc, how long have I got?" And the doctor sits back and strokes his chin and says, "Well, I'd say about 1,000 years, right?"
That's what we're
going to explore. And we're going to explore that this evening in two parts. We have two distinguished guests that we'll be talking with this evening, one who is joining us live, and I'll be bringing him out momentarily, and the other is via recording, and that will be in our second half. So I think let's get started.
I'm excited about this first guest, Phil. Ever since I've read the book he co-authored with Ray Kurzweil, I've wanted to visit with him, and so I'm glad he's on the show with us.
All right. Well, let's introduce Dr. Terry Grossman. He's a leading expert on anti-aging and life extension therapies, and he is the founder and medical director of the Frontier Medical Institute right here in Denver, Colorado. Terry, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Bill, Steve, thanks very much.
Well, it's great to have you, and we are so looking forward to getting into this topic. And as Stephen pointed out, this is something we've talked about more than once and have written about on the blog, including, your first book with Ray Kurzweil. And let's get the plug in as quickly as we can. I believe you've got a new book out with Ray Kurzweil.
Right. We originally wrote a book titled Fantastic Voyage back in 2004. And then we followed up with Transcend, 9 Steps to Living Well Forever. It just came out a couple months ago. And the latest book was designed to expand on the ideas and freshen them up, bring them up to the current time in terms of what people can do to live long enough to experience the changes that are coming so rapidly in the years ahead.
So We'll get into what goes on in both the books in a little greater detail. But before I lose track, I want to ask you our standard questions that we're asking all of our guests throughout the World Transformed series. So let me start with the first of those, and I think Stephen will give the second. But the first question for you, Dr. Terry Grossman, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you have witnessed in your lifetime?
I think there's no question that it's the progress that's been made in the world of computers and the Internet. They have been so transformative and have hastened the speed with which the world is changing to a greater extent than any other change that I've witnessed in my lifespan.
And the interesting thing about that one is it seems to impact so many different things. You can look at the Internet as an entity unto itself, or you can look at the way it has transformed entertainment, the way it has transformed business, the way it has transformed just about every aspect of our lives, particularly when people, you know, carrying their iPhones around and they're essentially online all the time. It's become this this almost sort of second world that we live in.
Well, right. I mean, it's led to the ability to solve problems with group minds rather than, you know, one person trying to solve a problem. You can post that question and receive answers from hundreds or thousands of people. So it allows for dramatic increases in sharing of knowledge.
Absolutely.
You know, it's interesting.
Sorry to cut you there, Stephen. I was just going to say what's interesting is I don't think that that Terry is the first guest to give that particular answer. I think we'll get that one again later this evening, not to do spoilers on the recorded interview, but that's interesting that that these two guests would give the same answer.
Absolutely. But, you know, it's not surprising, though, because that answer is, I mean, it seems accurate, doesn't it?
It's a huge transformation, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, looking forward, Terry.
It seems hard to imagine anything else that even comes close to what the computer world has done to change reality as we know it.
Absolutely. Well, looking forward, what do you think will be the greatest transformation that you'll see in your lifetime?
Well, I think it's going to go along the same lines, and I believe that during the latter half, towards the end of the first half of this century, in the 2040s, it's very likely that human beings and machines, computers, are not going to be distinct entities any longer. And I think we humans are becoming more and more linked to our technology. You had mentioned iPhones and enabling us.
I believe Dr. Groton. Terry, are you there?
We may have lost that connection. You might want to look at the switchboard, Stephen.
I'm looking here, and it looks live, but perhaps we'll need to call him again. While I'm doing that, you might want to introduce our chat host tonight.
All right. Well, our chat host, Michael Darling, joins us. Michael, are you actually here on the line with me?
I'm here, if you can hear me.
Outstanding. Well, we've got a terrific show started, but I guess the Blog Talk Radio utility wasn't going to let us really get the show going until you were here. So,
well, I'm gonna throw out two things. One, I was trying to stay young the old way. That's why I'm a few minutes late. I was playing tennis and trying to stay fit, and now I'm trying to recover the old-fashioned way with ice to reduce the swelling.
All right. Well, good luck on that. And
today, because we were doing the show tonight, we had the recorded interview with Aubrey, I thought it would be useful to go check in with Oprah. And I went to the Oprah website to figure out when was the last time they did their aging show, thinking maybe it was 3 or 4 months ago, which was the last time we brought it up, that Oprah had covered it. No, it was today. Today's Oprah show was what they called extreme life extension. And Dr. Oz was on talking to all manner of folks about living to be 120 years old.
Amazing. So, in fact, we were hoping to get into that, but I believe this is the second show she's done on that topic.
It's It might be the fourth, but it's definitely, I mean, it's a recurring topic now, and Dr. Oz is clearly a believer. One of the guys they had on today was doing organ regeneration, where people can grow their own bladder, and they showed a rat heart being grown in the lab in a liquid solution. And I was like, okay, if Dr. Oz is on board, that means Oprah's on board, because he's her guy.
Absolutely.
Terry, are you all on?
Yeah.
Okay, great. You're back. We lost you for a second there, and glad to have you back.
Oh, good. We were just talking amongst ourselves. That's no fun. We prefer to talk.
I was feeling for you, Doc.
Okay, thanks much. Yeah, I know what I was saying was towards the latter half of the century, you know, in the 2040s, I think that the integration of computing, the world of computers, and the wetware of our bodies, it won't be with an external device like a keyboard or a mouse or a cell phone or things like that. I think those things are going to be internalized, and we will be interconnected to one another on the internet, and we'll also have, you know, the ability to utilize computing devices within our brains in order to think more quickly, to communicate more quickly, and I think that that'll be the most transformative process, and I think it'll represent a true quantum shift in evolution, the same type of shift that occurred when Neanderthal became Cro-Magnon, basically the change from ape to human. That same change from human to post-human or transhuman will occur within really the next few decades due to our merging with our computers.
Terry, you know, the change from ape-like animals to humans took millions of years, and we're contemplating this change in a few decades. There's a scary side to that too, isn't there?
Well, it is. It is scary because the thing that differentiates species is one species doesn't breed with another species. So when the Cro-Magnons came on board, they didn't interbreed with the Neanderthals that they came from. And similarly, I think that this new species may be so radically different in terms of the fact that we'll be able to communicate at such greater speeds that we'll really be, in some effect, a different species entirely. And this could occur within the lifespans of many of us. So it is a jarring thought, and it will carry a lot of philosophical, social ramifications that are hard to describe. That's what they refer to as a singularity. A singular event that is so widespread and so wide sweeping, that it'll be difficult to contemplate what life will be like on the other side of that change.
Well, and at that point, you're talking about, as distinct from that shift from the proto-human to the fully human, from the fully human to the transhuman. Now we're talking about evolution by choice as a species, and also by individual choice, an individual within the one species can make a decision to move to the next. Is that a fair assessment of what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. We have that to some degree today. I mean, there are people that have various philosophical or religious views that they feel that they don't want to participate in certain medical procedures, and they're basically living in that type of very naturalistic type of world. Most of us do accept these modern medicine interventions. In the future, I think because the post-humans that are going to be enhanced like this will have the ability to think so quickly, communication between them and humans today will not be convenient, won't really be possible. So there will be people that choose to remain unenhanced, and there'll be people that choose to go through this change to the post-human state, and it'll remain to be seen how much we're able to communicate or how much we want to communicate with one another. The new group may decide to dispense with human flesh altogether, to live virtually and experience life in virtual reality and in multiple dimensions that we can't conceive of now, but it'd be hard to communicate that to people today because the experience is so much different.
Amazing stuff. Well, let's bring it a little closer back to home for now, and we'll kind of build our way back up to that point. Let's talk about your new book, Transcend: 9 Steps to Living Well Forever, as well as your I believe two earlier books, one with Ray Kurzweil, which was Fantastic Voyage: How to Benefit from Cutting Edge Science and Add Years to Your Life, and then another book I believe you wrote independently, which was called The Baby Boomer's Guide to Living Forever. Now I'm on the cusp. I'm sort of somewhere between a baby boomer and whatever came after them, but the whole living forever thing sounds pretty good to me. So I'm hoping you're gonna throw some tips our way here before the evening is over. But as Michael was mentioning during that little interim we had there, this has become a big topic on Oprah. Oprah's had a couple of guests on now, maybe done one show, maybe two. We're not even sure about life extension. And so for someone who has been doing serious work in this field, who runs a clinic in this field, has been publishing books in this field, do you see a major change? Is this becoming a mainstream idea? Is this becoming something that is falling into general acceptance? And if so, why would you say that's happening?
Well, I think people see what's going on in medicine today and our ability to do things that we couldn't do just a few years ago. Cloning and stem cells and the Human Genome Project, things along these lines. And with these rapid advances, I think people are coming to the belief that it will be possible that we will be able to conquer a fixed lifespan and that the previous 70 or 80 years or 90 years may not be all that we need to look forward to, and that we'll actually be able to have life expectancies well beyond a century. And then later in this century, we'll be talking about life expectancies measured in centuries themselves.
Well, the sooner the better on that. That's for sure. That sounds very good. But I guess there must be a flip side to the ideas becoming more nearly mainstream or gaining a wider acceptance. Which is, I noticed at the doctor the other day, and I picked up Newsweek. I don't normally read Newsweek, but the cover story was about Oprah supposedly pushing out all kinds of pseudoscience and crazy ideas, and there were a lot of odd things in there that we're not going to get into, like not vaccinating your kids and all kinds of other things. But one of the things they hit her really hard about was this show she had done on life extension. So do you find that you're getting both kinds of attention to a greater extent, or are there more people interested in it and now also more detractors as well?
Well, I compare the response that we got from 2004 when Ray Kurzweil and my first book was published, and there was a number of people that had objections and felt that we were talking pseudoscience and it wasn't likely to happen. And in 2009, we just don't hear it nearly as much. So I think in just the past 5 years, there has been a shift in the consciousness of a lot of people, and more people believe that it will happen just in a short period of time.
Absolutely. Terry, when you look around, folks are, here in the United States especially, it seems like people are, the obesity epidemic is as bad as it ever was, and in a lot of ways, we're not as healthy as we used to be as a nation. Is that going to cost us years?
Well, every generation in recorded history has lived longer than the preceding generation as a general rule. Like life expectancies, the United States were like 47 years in 1900, and now they're about 76 years. But they think that because of the obesity epidemic, the fact that 2 out of 3 adults is now either overweight or obese, and 1 in 3 children is overweight or obese, they think that our children may be the first generation to actually live a shorter life expectancy than their parents. So it is a dangerous trend, and I'm glad to see that the public health authorities are beginning to take it upon themselves to address this seriously. For instance, there is a bill that's been submitted to Congress to consider taxing sugary soft drinks at the rate of a penny an ounce, which is significant enough so that a six-pack of 12 cola drinks will cost 72 cents more, and that's enough to affect the consumption, they figure, by about 15%. So, and given that the largest cause of obesity is excess sugar consumption and the largest source of sugar consumption is soft drinks, I think that steps like this will be very helpful. We've seen that the public health authorities were able to slash the number of Americans who smoke cigarettes from nearly 50% of men in the 1950s and 1960s to less than 20% today. And I think we can do the same thing going from obesity rates, overweight rates of 67% of adults, slash them in half and beyond in a short period of time by taking aggressive measures. So I'm hopeful that these things will come to pass.
Well, we can certainly hope that people make better choices, whether they're motivated to do that by the government or they just take on a greater consciousness of their own health and their own lifestyle and begin making better choices. That is sort of the downside of the one of the other topics we'll be talking about in The World Transformed is this just tremendous increase in productivity that has occurred over the past century and where that's likely to lead us in terms of economic development and so forth. And there's a huge, wonderful upside of that, but the downside might be that we've started eating processed foods, that we have all these simple processed carbohydrates in our diet that aren't particularly good for us. And you know, there are probably myriad other downsides to that.
Well, the fact is that, you know, even though technology is changing our surroundings, we still carry software. Our genetic code was written 30, 40, 50,000 years ago, and it hasn't been updated. And our genetic code basically tells us that we need to get a lot of exercise, we need to eat a small amount of animal products, a lot of vegetable products. We really weren't designed to eat sugars or carbohydrate, grain-type foods to any great extent. And we don't live like our genetic code wants us to live in until we reach the point that we're essentially able to reprogram our genetic code, to reprogram our biochemistry. We need to live within the confines of what we're supposed to do in order to optimize our health. And that involves, you know, essentially getting a lot of exercise, using your body vigorously, and avoiding sugar to a tremendous extent, eating small amounts of animal products, eating large amounts of vegetables and some fruits and things like that. And I think if we do that, we can achieve optimal health so that we can live long enough to take advantage of what technology will have to offer soon.
Terry, I think you anticipated my next question. I was about to ask you. Aubrey de Grey, our next guest, talks about seven problems that have to be solved in order to have radical life extension. And in the work that you do on a daily basis, what approach do you take to help people live long enough to get to this radical life extension we're talking about?
Well, what Ray and I talk about are the three bridges. Bridge one is the medical and technological therapeutics we have available to us today. We'll use those to help us to live long enough to reach bridge two, which is the biotech revolution centering around things like stem cells, cloning, and things like that, which will then lead to bridge three, which is nanotechnology. So in my practice today at Frontier Medical Institute, what we try to do to patients that come to see us and they're looking to live long enough to take advantage of these technologies, it basically centers on two main pillars, and that's prevention of disease and early detection of disease. And prevention, obviously, is the more important of the two because, obviously, you'd rather prevent a disease than detect it early. But if you can't prevent it, then at least you want to be able to detect it at an early stage when full recovery is still possible. So what I try to do is help people to perform the type of tests that will assess their current health status so that they can know exactly what they need to do to prevent disease to as great an extent possible, and then also do a battery of diagnostic tests to detect disease early. We know that, for instance, heart disease, which is the number one killer, 27% of deaths come from heart disease. Cancer is number two, about a little over 23%. So over half the deaths are from heart disease and cancer alone. And we have the ability to detect heart disease and cancer to a far greater extent than most people realize. But unfortunately, due to financial constraints, insurance company constraints, and all types of other issues, we're not doing a very good job of it. And we continue to see people, celebrities, people in our daily lives, family members and friends, being diagnosed with advanced stages of heart disease and cancer and dying from these diseases when they could be detected early and really nipped in the bud.
So, Terry, let me ask you about that just to clarify. When you say that there are things we can do to prevent cancer, to prevent heart disease, are you talking lifestyle choices or are you talking about medical interventions that can prevent these things from catching on?
I'm talking about both. For instance, you know, if you do some tests and you find out that you've begun to develop some early signs of, you know, cholesterol deposits within the arteries of your heart, which will in time lead to a heart attack type of problems, you can take some lifestyle steps, make sure that your blood pressure is controlled. Perhaps that just involves losing some weight, getting some exercise, taking some supplements, changing your diet. But maybe it needs prescription medications to control your blood pressure. Maybe you have, you know, elevated cholesterol levels, elevated triglycerides, things that will clog up the arteries. It's the same story. Do the lifestyle measures first. If diet, exercise, stress management, supplementation will do it, that's fine. If not, we have statin drugs, we have niacin, we have all types of other medications that can help with that as well. So use the best of both. And there are even cases where the disease is more advanced and you may need to submit to an intervention, perhaps a surgical procedure, so that something you know more catastrophic doesn't happen down the line. So we use all the tools that are available to us.
Okay, now we have a question. I believe it's from the chat room, and I believe it goes to the notion of the three bridges that you and Ray Kurzweil talked about in your book. But the question is, when will our accelerating technology allow us to no longer rely on exercise, vitamin pills, and diets to be healthy?
I think that will probably occur during the late 2020s. There are medications right now that they're called exercise mimetics. And what they do is we know that if you exercise regularly, you'll raise your HDL cholesterol, which is the beneficial cholesterol, lower your triglycerides, and also lengthen your telomeres. And telomeres are essentially linked with how long we'll live. So we know that exercise will do that. We also know that taking antioxidant supplements like vitamin C and vitamin E will lengthen our telomeres by 5%. I think that by the late 2020s, with the technologies we'll have available, exercise will become more of an option, and you'll be able to achieve the same type of fitness that we can achieve today by exercising, you know, 3 to 6 times a week just by taking an exercise mimetic pill, which, by the way, these medications are already available and in early stages of development. They need to go through a number of years of testing to make sure that they're safe as well as effective. But I think that within 15 years or so, they'll be available for commercial use.
Follow-up question to that is, why can't we have food highly nutritious in the form of a cookie?
Well, it's interesting. There are people that are working on creating meat, for instance, that is low in fat, low in cholesterol, but has a lot of the taste and mouthfeel of regular meat that doesn't involve animals at all through cloning processes. And I think within the next 5 years, we will have some cloned food products that are very nutritious, that have a lot of the benefits of standard food without a lot of the downsides of things like steak and hot fudge sundaes and things like that. And we'll be able to eat these type of foods in the near future without the current health consequences that come when you eat them regularly.
And speaking of which, thank you, Sally, for those questions. By the way, if you didn't get the warning, get rid of that frozen cookie dough. That stuff's no good. It's a killer, so don't be eating that stuff. All right, well, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We've got Dr. Terry Grossman with us this evening, and we'll be talking with Aubrey de Grey just a little bit later this evening. Our topic is life extension. If you're listening live, please join our chat in the Blog Talk Radio chat room or leave a comment at speculist.com. Now, let's talk about your kind of working relationship with Ray Kurzweil. Ray is going to be a guest on the program where we talk about the singularity, and that's coming up here in a few weeks. So it's very interesting to me. Here we've got Ray. He's this singularitarian, the leader of the movement, if it is a movement, and if anyone can be designated as that. And you're a medical doctor. So Ray talks about the law of accelerating returns, and he talks about moving consciousness into a new substrate and those kinds of ideas. So how much of that informs what you do? Is that part of your focus, or are you concerned strictly with the biological and medical steps that we can take now to get us to that next bridge, or how do those two things work together?
Well, I'm interested in those topics, and Ray and I discuss them very frequently with one another. But in terms of my day-to-day life and my medical practice, I'm pretty much in the trenches of helping patients do what they can do today. So it's, recommending what tests that they need to do and what interventions they need to do to both detect disease, prevent disease, and to keep themselves in optimal health for as long as possible. So that's really where I involve my work on a day-to-day basis.
It's more a matter of getting us to that next stage than obviously your work doesn't have to do with the artificial intelligence and the computers and that kind of thing. You're not touching on that.
No. My day-to-day work, I'm a medical doctor, so I'm in the clinic, taking care of patients day by day. So that's what I occupy myself with. And then I also like to write books and lecture and things like that. But basically, I focus on the treatment of one particular disease that is suffered by 100% of the population and which so far has proven to be 100% fatal, and that's the disease of aging. So that's really the focus of my work.
So let's talk a little – go ahead, Stephen. I'm sorry.
I think this is another question from the chat room. Our entire – well, most of the medical field is they are – are geared less towards preventative medicine and more towards dealing with problems once there already are problems. And I don't know if this is quite the best way to ask it, but, I mean, how much of what you do is covered by health insurance? Are they even interested in paying for what you do?
Unfortunately, medicine as it's practiced today is reactive rather than proactive. And insurance companies, I think, are missing the boat when they are willing to pay $75,000 or $100,000 for an angioplasty and stent or a bypass to treat heart disease, but then won't pay $200 or $300 for a CAT scan to determine if you have any plaque in your arteries. And I really think that they're missing it, and as a result, it's costing us a lot more money for health care, because it's not really health care, it's sickness care. And hopefully in the years ahead, as we redesign our health care system, which we really need to do right now because it's on the verge of becoming more than 20% of our gross domestic product, that we will look at this and put a greater emphasis on preventive strategies.
I agree completely, and I think that it has to go that direction. I don't see any way around it.
Yeah, they say that every dollar that you spend on preventive medical care can create or result in savings of anywhere from $2 to $6. So it's not only good health sense, it's good business sense.
If anyone in the insurance industry is listening, okay, there it is right there. You can actually save money. You can make money off this stuff, for crying out loud. I was actually going to ask, my follow-up question was going to be, do you think that attitude from the insurance company, in your opinion as a medical professional, has anything to do with the fact that they're a bunch of weasels? But
well, the thing that I do have an axe to grind with the insurance companies over. Congress is looking at a practice that they do nowadays, where when they don't have any problem collecting money from patients month after month, but then when a patient has an illness, has a hospitalization, and puts in a claim, they will go over their application with a fine-tooth comb, and if they find that anything was omitted or there was any mistake made on the application, they'll deny paying the entire claim. And I think this is really unfair because, you know, for instance, someone might have forgotten that they had a bunion surgery 12 years ago, didn't put it on their application, end up having a heart attack and a bypass, $100,000 bill, and because they forgot to write down that they'd had bunion surgery 12 years before, the entire claim is thrown out and their insurance is made null and void. So luckily, Congress has taken a look at this, and I hope that this type of injustice in the public will be ended soon.
We can certainly hope. Well, let's staying with talking about your practice just for a moment. Tell us a little bit about it. You're located in Lakewood, Colorado, and can you give us some feel for what size of a practice it is, how many patients you're dealing with?
Yeah, I see people. I see two kinds of patients: people that are looking to do these longevity evaluations, we call them, which are assessments to do the early detection and the preventive strategies. And about half my time is spent seeing these patients, and I see three or four patients a week coming in. Today I had a patient that came to see me from Florida. Yesterday there was somebody from North Carolina. Last week we had a higher-up official from the prime minister of a country in the Middle East. So we see people from all over the country, from all over the world, because as evidenced by Oprah, there is a tremendous interest in health these days. People want to live in optimal health for as long as possible. So we do longevity evaluations, which last anywhere from half a day to 2 days. There are various types of programs. And then the other half of my time is spent taking care of people that have already developed disease, heart disease, cancer, neurological problems. And I try to find creative strategies to help them that are not typically available with conventional therapies. So we use some complementary medicine and things along those lines. So that basically occupies what I do for the bulk of my practice.
And how long have you been in this particular field? How long have you specialized just in aging and life extension?
Well, in 1993, I went to one of the first meetings for the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. Anti-aging medicine was formed, I think, in 1992. So I really got in on the ground floor of that. I've been very interested in it ever since, I think largely because of the fact that I was experiencing some changes that were consistent with aging, and I wanted to see what I could do in my own life. And I became fascinated with the prospect of treating aging as a disease and seeing what we could do to slow down and stop it, and if possible, to reverse it. So it's become a passion of mine is to treat the disease of aging.
Well, we're certainly glad that someone's working on it, that's for sure. I'm sorry, Stephen, go ahead.
I was just going to ask him, for listeners who haven't read your books, what are, you know, perhaps maybe the top three things that they could do to get started living forever living indefinitely?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you got to remember the theme is live long enough to live forever. So what we can do today is remain in health long enough to take advantage of the things that will enable us to live for far longer in the near future. And I would think that the three things that would make a huge amount of difference are, number one, in diet, stop eating sugar. I call sugar in the book White Satan. It's the White Satan. I mean, it destroys your health. It creates heart disease, leads to high blood pressure and obesity. And sugar is the only food that cancer cells can eat. So every time you eat sugar, you're creating a backdrop to destroy your health. And people are eating, average Americans eating 145 pounds of sugar a year. And that's a tragedy. So number one, quit eating sugar. Number two, we've become very sedentary, a bunch of couch potatoes. It's natural. Our cavewoman genes tell us to exercise as little as possible because exercise burns calories. And we shouldn't do it frivolously because our genes from 30,000 years ago, we don't know when the next famine is coming, so conserve calories, don't exercise. And we don't have to exercise nowadays. So you really need to realize that it's natural to not want to exercise, but our bodies need exercise. So you got to force yourself to exercise. There are programs that you can follow that only take 20 minutes a day. By exercising at a high rate, you can get all the benefits of an hour of training. So a 20-minute-a-day commitment to exercise. And I think controlling stress. Stress is a killer. So many of us are stressed out because of the economy, fear of losing jobs, things like that. You need to do things to control stress, whether it's taking a mini vacation, engaging in a hobby, using a hot tub. There's all types of things people can do to help control their stress. But I think those three things are really hit some of the three keys.
So it turns out if you want to extend your life, the three major things to do would be obviously there's a lot more to it than this, but the very sensible things that just about anybody's doctor would tell them to do. Is that fair?
Well, I don't know. Did your doctor tell you to stop eating sugar and exercise?
No, that's a good point. He tells me to exercise. He tells me to cut the stress. He has not told me to stop eating sugar. That's an excellent point.
Well, you got a good doctor because at least he told you to exercise and to control the stress. Because a lot of doctors, they're under the gun. They're in a hurry and are more just inclined to write a prescription and not provide as much counseling. So you have a good doctor.
All right. Well, I'll be sure and tell him that you said that. Before we move on from this, just want to clarify that when you say cut out sugar, obviously you're talking about refined sugar, not fruit and that sort of thing.
No, fruit's okay. Dried fruit is too sugary. You should avoid that. And fruit juices you should avoid because they concentrate the sugar too much. But, you know, don't eat fruit all day long. Don't eat a diet of strictly fruit. But, one or two servings of fruit a day is fine.
Got it. Okay, good. That's a relief. Michael, any questions from the chat room for Dr. Terry Grossman?
Well, you got some of them, and some of the ones, I think the rest was sort of a discussion tangential, but I would just want to clarify that when you say no sugar, we're really talking, refined cane sugar or high fructose corn syrup. We're not talking about naturally occurring sugars.
Well, if you're talking about things like honey or molasses, which are, quote, naturally occurring sugar, yeah, I'm talking about those too. I think we need to avoid basically what are referred to as high glycemic index carbohydrates. And that doesn't only include sugar and high fructose corn syrup, but it also includes things that release their sugar quickly, like refined flour products, white bread, white rice, white pasta, and even white potatoes, which release their sugar quickly. So, the discussion of sugar is quite extensive. And people should learn about which foods release their sugar quickly, what are the high glycemic index foods, and avoid those as well.
So fluffy
okay.
carbs, refined sugar, but the strawberries that I use to make my smoothie and then sweeten my coffee with it, that's okay.
Yeah, that's true. But in general, smoothies are dangerous because smoothies, you typically take a large amount of fruit, fruit juices and things like that, bananas and berries, and a fruit smoothie, an 8-ounce fruit smoothie, has more sugar in it than an 8-ounce serving of a soft drink. So there's significant amounts of sugar in fruit smoothies. So I'm a believer in juicing, but more in vegetable juicing than in fruit juicing, because it's just simply too much sugar in fruit juice.
So Michael, you start putting some asparagus. Start putting some asparagus juice in your coffee. You'll be fine. It'll be better for you too. Okay. Well, our time is just about up. I can't believe how quickly it has flown past. But before we let you go, Dr. Grossman, anything else you'd like to share with us? Upcoming plans or things we should be aware of?
Well, I think that just keep your eyes out on stem cells. I think that what we're going to see in the next year or two from the world of stem cells is going to be just staggering. And I'm very excited about what the prospects are. We talk about how nanobots are going to be coming later in the 2030s to circulate in our bloodstreams. I think nanobots in the form of stem cells are going to be circulating in our bloodstreams within the next few years and solving problems that we haven't been able to solve before. So I just want to end by wishing everybody happy anti-aging.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks for being with us on the program, and we look forward to hearing more from you in the future, and we would like to invite you to come back and to be with us again sometime on Fast Forward Radio.
Well, thanks so much. Take care now.
All right. Dr. Terry Grossman, thank you. And you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about life extension. And we're going to move now into our second half of the program. We've just spoken with Dr. Terry Grossman, had a live conversation with him, and what a terrific guest, eh, Stephen?
Absolutely, absolutely. I knew he would be, though. I've read a couple of his books now, and, well, you know, I guess there is a difference between being able to write and being able to be on a radio show, but he's definitely got some great ideas.
Yeah, indeed, and very articulate, really drives the point home well. So it's nice having a chance to hear what's happening and that progress is being made, kind of on the ground, kind of with patients. You know, people are actually taking steps now to extend their lives. So we'll be shifting gears a little bit as we get into the interview that we recorded earlier this week. We had to pre-record this one just because our next guest, Dr. Aubrey de Grey, is in the UK, and there was no good way for the time to work out. This show airing in the evenings in North America live would have been 3 a.m. for him, and we said, no, that's crazy. We'll pre-record the interview and we'll play it back. But we will have an opportunity to take a break during that pre-recorded interview, and Michael will check in with what's happening in the chat room, and we'll see if people have comments or thoughts on what Aubrey de Grey is sharing with us. So I think without further ado, Stephen, let's listen to Dr. Aubrey de Grey.
We are very pleased and honored to welcome Dr. Aubrey de Grey back to Fast Forward Radio. Aubrey is a biogerontologist. He is the creator of the Methuselah Mouse Prize, and he's the chief science officer of the SENS Foundation. He is the author of the best-selling book, Ending Aging, in which he describes in some detail the finite number of problems that need to be solved in order to bring an end to this phenomenon that we call human aging, and what steps should be taken to solve each of those problems. Aubrey, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to talk to you. It's been almost 2 years, I'm thinking now, since we've had you on. So we'll try not to let so much time go by in the future. Obviously, there's a lot of catching up that we have to do, and we want to get into talking about the SENS Foundation and what SENS means. Before we do, I wonder if we could take just a minute. I've got two introductory questions that I'm asking everyone throughout this series that we're doing called The World Transformed about generally what's happening in the world and what you see happening in the world. So I've got these two questions. We'd like to start out with those. And the first of them is, Aubrey de Grey, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you have witnessed in your lifetime?
Wow, that's a hard one, isn't it? I guess the thing that makes it such a hard question to answer is that all of the major transformations of our world that have happened during my lifetime have interacted with each other. So it's hard to, you know, separate them out and put them in a league table, if you like. I mean, I certainly think that the rise of the internet is something without which the world would be completely different. I can still just about remember going to a physical library to read academic literature, for example. And,
sure.
You know, actually having to pick up a telephone in order to get in touch with somebody. I would say that has to be the number one if by our world we define it as the world in which I directly experience. If we look at the world, the whole world in general, then I guess we'd have to say the rise of the conflict between Islam and Western culture, which is, of course, a rather more recent phenomenon in its most extreme form, but it certainly is a big deal. But I think if we restrict it to within Western culture, which is, of course, my own experience, then I'd say the rise of the internet.
Well, that's an interesting way to break it down, actually, to look at this big technological change versus this big kind of socio-economic cultural phenomenon occurring in the world.
Aubrey, what's the biggest transformation you expect to see in your lifetime?
Well, at this point, I'm still pretty optimistic that I will see the defeat of aging being implemented in our lifetime. And if that's true, if that does happen, then for sure and certain, that's the one that's going to make the most difference to everybody. I think that even if we were to see the arrival of artificial general intelligence, that probably it would not have as significant effect as the defeat of aging.
That's you know what's interesting about that answer, Aubrey? One, no big surprise that you would give us that one. But so far, and we're early in this series, but so far, out of four people that we've asked that question, three have said the end of aging, the indefinite extension of human life is the biggest change. And one of the answers given by the other person was the transfer of human consciousness to another substrate, which, of course, is another kind of means of achieving, rather extreme life extension. So that seems to be a recurring theme, that as people look ahead and look at big transformations coming, so far that seems to be a major one that that people are looking for.
Well, certainly, yeah. Certainly it's the biggest one for those of us who get to stick around to see it that would otherwise not be able to see all these other things. I mean, it's, longevity is the key to getting to see everything else, I guess.
Yeah, it's the enabling transformation for traveling into the future as we like to describe it. So let's talk about the possibility for that occurring. And we mentioned that you are the chief science officer of the SENS Foundation, and SENS is Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence. That's this engineering approach to solving the problem of human aging. Basically, I said that that you, in your book, Ending Aging, talked about a finite set of problems. Basically, there's seven of them, and let me I'll read them out and tell me if I get anything wrong. But they are number one, cell loss or cell atrophy; number two, junk outside the cells; number three, these cross links outside the cells caused by something called AGEs. You've got death-resistant cells, mitochondrial mutations, junk inside cells, and then nuclear mutations. So all this micro stuff happening at the cellular level, seven problems as you described in the book. We solve those problems, and we cure aging, we end aging. Is that the essence of SENS?
That's pretty much it, yes. If you want a little bit more elaboration of that, first of all, it's important to understand that these seven things are categories. So within each of these categories, there are various examples. Different tissues are affected in slightly different ways. And the reason why this is a useful classification into these seven categories is because the ways that we think we can address each of these examples within a given category have a lot in common. So if you can address one of them, then you're most of the way towards addressing the others within that same category. But it does mean that there is a lot still that we don't know about particular examples that we might have to address. The other thing that's worth mentioning is that we can't be absolutely certain that these seven categories are the whole story. But we can be pretty optimistic that they will be the whole story for a little while, that we'll be able to extend lifespan by a fair bit, maybe 30 or 50 years at least, before we start hitting any eighth or ninth category. And, of course, that means that we'll be able to buy enough time to develop new approaches to addressing those categories too.
Yeah, if we can. So the idea being, if we can maybe address one or two of these, we buy ourselves some time, and that gives us time to work on some of the others?
Oh, well, I'm afraid we can't quite go that far, I know. It is fairly clear that we'll have to address all seven of the ones we know about reasonably well in order to get let's say, 30 years of additional health. Because all of them, the reason that we know about them already is because they are significant contributors to aging in what's currently a normal lifetime.
Just to go with that, if you quote unquote cure three of the seven, that probably won't buy you that much. You would have to address all seven to actually get the benefit.
That's right. We wouldn't have to address any of them completely, but we'd have to address all of them reasonably well.
I see. Okay. Now, the approach that you talk about, I think it's important that the E in SENS stands for engineering. We're talking about an engineering approach to solving the problem. You know, as distinct from how a doctor might have looked at this problem or how a theoretical scientist might have looked at this problem, you addressed it as an engineering problem. You said, here's the seven glitches we have to fix, and here's the potential fixes for this. Now, taking this engineering approach, how is this different from the approach that a typical scientific researcher might make in going about doing
it? Well, right, yeah. It's actually very different from the way that basic scientists work. It's not so different from the way that regular medical doctors work. In fact, sometimes I think it's appropriate to consider medicine to be a branch of engineering. But it's very different from the way that basic scientists work. Basic scientists are interested in understanding the details of a particular process, really for the sake of understanding, rather than for the sake of using that understanding for human benefit or anything. And as such, often basic scientists don't know when to stop, so to speak. They don't know when they've discovered enough that it's now possible to engage in the rational design of interventions that might be able to manipulate nature. And that's just as true in this case of the biology of aging as it is in any case. Certainly many of the basic biogeontologists that I work with are very much focused on understanding aging better and better and better. And they are, in my view, unreasonably pessimistic about how well we need to understand aging before we'll have a fighting chance of doing anything about it.
Right. So taking this engineering approach, this kind of orthogonal approach to how scientists would perhaps address the problem, does that make it more difficult to sell the idea of SENS into the scientific community as a whole? Has that been a roadblock, or does that continue?
Yes, it certainly does, and I've had to do a sort of end run around that problem for the past several years, really. On the one hand, I do try to address that problem head on. I try to, discuss my preferred approaches and other approaches to combating aging with my colleagues in the biology of aging. But often it's very difficult even to get on the same wavelength at all. However, what I have found is that it's extremely easy, or if it's much easier, to get buy-in from very authoritative and prestigious scientists who do not themselves work on the biology of aging, or at least they don't think they do, but they do work on the same sort of approach to manipulating health in respect of particular diseases or particular other health conditions. So in particular, what this comes down to is talking to people who work in regenerative medicine, who are interested in using things like stem cell therapy or tissue engineering or gene therapy to address particular health conditions. And when I come to them, essentially what I'm doing is I'm telling them that their technology can be used in conjunction with the technology from a lot of other people to address the problem of aging. And in general, people who work in regenerative medicine are pretty receptive to that message. And so I've been able really to put together a whole new community of people, a field which I like to call biomedical gerontology as opposed to biogerontology, thereby, of course, emphasizing the goal-directed nature of the whole thing, the idea that we're actually trying to create new medicine. And so in my conferences, for example, that I run every other year in Cambridge in England, and also in my journal, Rejuvenation Research, I essentially bring together people who would not normally be talking to each other because they wouldn't necessarily see that their expertise overlaps with the other people's expertise, and bringing these people together and getting them to appreciate that, between them, they can contribute perhaps very decisively to combating the world's most important health condition, namely aging.
Aubrey,
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask Aubrey. In the last couple of years since we visited, what excites you the most as far as the research that's going on?
Right, that's a pretty hard one because, of course, the nature of this divide and conquer approach to combating aging, we're splitting it up into these seven categories, and then within each category, there's lots of examples. The nature of that means that there's things exciting you all the time, but they're really quite technical things usually. They're a long way away from actually implementation, and yet I know that they are important and perhaps, absolutely indispensable steps forward towards the solution of one or another of these various problems. I guess there are, however, a couple of things I would point to. First of all, there's one that everybody more or less has heard about who's paid any attention to the medical news, which is the development of induced pluripotent stem cells, the ability to take differentiated cells and essentially de-differentiate them back into an extremely primitive state. very much like an embryonic stem cell, which can then be redifferentiated into whatever lineage one may be interested in for the purpose of addressing some particular health condition. This is something that came out of Japan 3 years ago, and after about a year of a certain degree of skepticism, to be honest, a number of labs around the world succeeded in reproducing this technology, and now everybody's doing it, and it's essentially, you know, swept the world. It's the reason it's so important is because it means that we now have a vastly simpler approach than we ever had before to the creation of cell therapies which do not have problems of immune rejection and therefore, you know, immunosuppression and so on. And I'm pretty sure that it's going to be an absolutely decisive, absolutely indispensable component of regenerative medicine in general, and certainly regenerative medicine for aging, which is what SAMS is all about. Another thing that I would point to, which I think is very important, is that a number of the components, well, a few of the components of SAMS are now making their way into bona fide clinical trials. So the first clinical trial for embryonic stem cells has just started being run by Geron. And also there is a phase 3 clinical trial now going on to address the removal of amyloid in the brain in Alzheimer's disease, which is something that I think is going to prove to be very important, not only in Alzheimer's disease, but also elsewhere. That's something that's been proceeding with very few hitches for the past 10 years, and it's almost reached the clinic already. So that's pretty exciting.
Absolutely. Are there any technical roadblocks that have come up lately that have you discouraged at all?
I can only think of one that I would really point to, actually, which is pretty good news, because, of course, that's the downside of having a divide-and-conquer approach, where you've got to get a whole bunch of things working with an awful lot of opportunities for roadblocks. Yeah, there's actually only one thing, one area of sense that I would say has not moved forward in the past 2 years, and might arguably even, we might even say it's moved a little bit backwards. And that is the elimination of cross-links. So you mentioned number 3 out of the list in the order that you listed the 7 problems of SAMS. Extracellular cross-links formed by these things called ATEs, a process called glycation. So when I came up with SAMS back in 2000, 2001, the best bet was that we were quite close to being able to address this problem pretty well, because there had already been considerable success in model organisms, especially in rats and dogs, with regard to using a small compound called ALT711 to break a particular category of crosslink that turned out to be easier to break than a lot of the others. And the experiments that were being done seemed to indicate that this was having a big, big effect on the health conditions that are caused by an excess accumulation of these crosslinks, in particular hypertension. However, the bad news turned out to be that it didn't work very well in humans when people tried to do clinical trials. Now, some people have argued that clinical trials are not done correctly, but my personal reading of this at the moment is that the best interpretation of what's happened is that this particular category of crosslinks is simply not so abundant in humans as it is in shorter-lived species like rats, for example. And there are various reasons why that would be. Now, of course, what that means is that this compound may still work, but it won't have so significant an effect, because the other types of crosslinks, which are not affected by this compound, will still dominate and will still have the same effect on hypertension or whatever that they were having anyway. So that means that what we need to look for is more sophisticated approaches that will break these more resistant crosslinks, the tougher ones that are harder to crack. And so far, we haven't got very far with that, but there are some ideas out there. But that, yeah, I would say is the one thing that's gone backwards over the past few years.
Well, and the upside to that would be, if I can put my positive spin on that, it's that at least this research is being done. At least we're finding out. We're getting a feel for what's going to be more effective, what's going to be less effective, and what will be effective in a more limited way, and those kinds of things. So even a roadblock such as this one is. If you take the really broad view, it's a good sign in that we're learning about what works and what doesn't. Now, with that in mind, where do you expect the most significant progress to be in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, wow. Of course, this is technology. This is pioneering technology, and it's always very hard to know where the progress is going to come. But it's impossible to know, to be perfectly honest. However, if you look at a 10-year time frame, then I guess I would be pretty optimistic that all of these 7 categories will have been pretty much defeated and pretty much solved. Not necessarily in humans, in fact, mostly not in humans by that time, I would say, but certainly in mice especially. And most of the important work needs to be done in mice because they're the one species that, first of all, have a sufficiently short lifespan, and secondly, perhaps even more importantly, we have so many tricks, so many biotechnological tricks that we can use now to manipulate the genetics of mice, for example, and to make them good models of the human health conditions that go together to form aging. I think that we will have a good, pretty darn good chance now within 10 years of getting to the proof of concept of the entire sense spectrum. That's the milestone that I have historically been calling robust mouse rejuvenation. And I define that in terms of lifespan, where you take mice that have already got a respectable lifespan and you treat them in a whole bunch of different ways simultaneously, starting in middle age, starting when they're already, let's say, two-thirds of the way through their lives, and you double or treble the amount of time that they live, the remaining lifespan that they have from that point. And you've got to do that by bona fide rejuvenation, by getting these tricks to really work so that the mice stay really healthy, like young adult mice, through most of that period. I think there's a pretty damn good chance that we'll be there within 10 years now.
And for it to be a proof of concept, a true proof of concept per the kind of criteria we talked about earlier, that would mean that to some extent all 7 of the problems would be addressed and you would actually see a significant extension of the lifespan of the mouse. Would that be an immortal mouse, an indefinitely living mouse, or what are we talking about?
Absolutely not. Okay, so there's a couple of things to say. First of all, there are considerable differences between mice and humans. And in particular, the reason why mice live such a small amount of time is because they're really not very good at not aging. So it's going to be easier to fix mice up than it would be to fix up a human. And so even after we get this proof of principle, it's going to be a little while before we can transfer those same principles to humans. Additionally, some of the differences between mice and humans are such that we would have to do some rather clever tricks to make the mice sufficiently similar to humans in order to test the things that we would want to eventually use on humans. This is true especially for cancer, which is something that just works rather differently in mice than what it does in humans. But there are quite a few nice tricks now to make mice whose cancers behave more similarly. The same is actually true for atherosclerosis, which mice normally just don't get, but you can make them get it by doing particular genetic modifications. But all of these things mean that the principle will be at the level of the lifespan, but they won't necessarily involve exactly the same tricks. And we might indeed be able to get as far as a couple of years of additional life in mice without actually having having much progress on, let's say, 1 or 2 of the 7 things. We might be able to get that amount of extension just with 5 of the 7 things, for example. I wouldn't rule that out, simply because mice are not very good at not aging in the first place.
Aubrey, you're talking about taking a mouse that's about 2 years old and giving him another 2 or 3 years of life. Is that basically it?
That's right. So a long-lived mouse strain is a mouse strain that lives for about 3 years maximum. So if we take mice that are of a strain like that, and we wait until they're 2 years old, then the milestone that I have defined is that we give them an additional 2 years that they wouldn't normally have. So in other words, we take the remaining lifespan from 1 year out to 3 years.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is sort of a loaded question, I know, but I mean, once we have that and, the world at large sees that we can do this for mice, do you think that in some ways the dam will burst and the money that needs to go towards this project will start hitting and we can see some progress at that point?
I'm absolutely certain of it. I've said this since the beginning of my talking about discussions about science, and nothing has happened that has in any way changed my mind on this. I'm completely convinced that what's going to happen is going to be the following steps. Step one will be that the experiment will be done, we'll create these mice. Step two will be that, of course, my colleagues who work on the biology of aging will get a lot of phone calls from journalists, the way they always do when any significant breakthrough happens in the biology of aging. And people will ask them, what does this mean in terms of the potential for interventions that will affect humans? And the big difference that this particular breakthrough will make is that my colleagues, I believe, my colleagues will be able at that point and willing to actually say, yes, this means that the engineering approach to the combating of aging has been shown to be potentially effective. And therefore, we don't know how long it's going to be before we get robust human rejuvenation, but it's only a matter of time. My colleagues will certainly not be willing to say how much time it's going to be, but they will be willing to say that it's only a matter of time. And that's all it's going to take. What's going to happen then is that Oprah Winfrey is going to get up on stage and say, well, in that case, I'd rather be one of the people who make the cut rather than not make the cut. And at that point, it will instantly become impossible to get elected unless you have a manifesto commitment to push this forward as fast as humanly possible and to have a bona fide war on aging. So, yes, absolutely. My job will be done at that point.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Dr. Aubrey de Grey, the chief scientist of the SENS Foundation and the creator of the M-Prize. Aubrey spoke with us earlier this week on the subject of life extension, and we're talking about the age of the indefinite lifespan. How long until humanity has a what are we looking for, Stephen? No expiration date, I guess, is the right term there. When do we reach that point? Well, Aubrey's taking us down that down the path towards how we can get there. Earlier this evening, we spoke live with Dr. Terry Grossman, who had suggestions on what we can do now to live longer. And I think in the interest of time, we should probably go ahead and just jump right into the second part of the interview, and then we'll recap any questions from the chat room after the conclusion of the interview.
Okay, let's start part two.
All right. Just to make you make one more prediction that you're not comfortable with, from that point until, we have an Oprah who can be secure in her future, how long are we talking about, do you think?
Yeah, I'm not so coy. I bite the bullet and I do make predictions like this. But, of course,
okay.
I'm always very careful to emphasize how speculative they are.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I still think that it's what I, again, have been saying for several years is roughly true, namely that the interval that it's going to take between the arrival of this proof of concept in mice and the arrival of the corresponding amount of progress in humans is going to be about 15 years. And that's what I would say is the 50-50 probability. So there's a 50-50 chance that it will take 15 years to get from mice to humans. Of course, we could get unlucky. We could come across lots of problems that we'd never heard of before, and it could take 100 years. And I would not want to say that there's less than a 10% chance of that. But if we're looking at a 50% chance, I think it's 15 years between the mice and the humans.
Okay, so a 50-50 chance of about 25 years from now. Is that right?
That's what I would say. And it's coming down, of course. Every bit of progress that is made, even including progress that is not made for the purpose of combating aging, does help to improve those probabilities. So, for example, the development of these induced pluripotent stem cells that I mentioned a moment ago, that has, in my view, a considerable impact. And it probably means that if you really question me, I would say that the interval between the mice and the humans has probably gone down to about 13 or 12 years rather than 15 years, which is what I was saying it was 5 or 8 years ago.
So let's talk about the Oprah factor here for a moment. It's interesting that she was on the cover of Newsweek a while back for talking about all these crazy things, and one of the crazy things was, in fact, life extension. So there's this question of public perception of what it is that you're doing, and public perception, public awareness of the idea of extending life at all. I had this really interesting experience driving home from work the other day. It was the news had just come over the radio that Michael Jackson had died. And so this radio station that I listen to, I'm old enough, I listen to the oldies station, and they're playing nothing but Michael Jackson songs, and I'm hearing a bunch of music I haven't heard in years. And suddenly this real feeling of sadness overcomes me, and I'm thinking, this is insane because I'm not a big Michael Jackson fan. I don't think I ever bought any of his records or anything, but it transports me back to this period in the early 80s. I'd go hang out with my brothers, MTV would come on, Thriller would be on. This kind of nostalgia hits, and it reminded me of something that I had read just a few weeks ago in association with the commemoration of D-Day, which was that the Normandy invasion is in the process now of passing from human memory, that the soldiers who were there for that event are now, the youngest of them are about 83 years old, that they're dying off at a really depressing rate, and they've halved the time between when they have commemorations just so that some of the guys will have a chance of getting there. And I took that one further, and I did a Wikipedia search because I didn't know. It was something that had been true my whole life, and I wasn't sure if it was still true. I was like, well, are there any World War I veterans left? And sure enough, it turns out that there are like a couple in the UK. There's one in Canada. There's one in the US. If there are any Germans, for whatever reason, they're not listed in the Wikipedia article. But the idea that occurred to me that I hadn't thought of before, the reason I was feeling sad was it's not an awareness of my own mortality. It's an awareness of generational mortality. This notion that that everything that my cohort knows and has experienced and has made the real world real for us is scheduled to terminate, just as it has almost completely done for that World War I generation, and just as we see it happening in a very dramatic way for the World War II generation. So. Of course, when you talk generations, this baby boom generation always comes up. Now, is there a bubble that we're going to hit with them in terms of awareness of their generation's mortality for them as individuals and for them as a group? Does that factor into a positive perception of what it is that you're doing?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the aspect of what you're saying that one needs to focus on is those people's own awareness of their own mortality, as opposed to the sort of thing you were talking about, where you're talking about your increasing awareness of the mortality of generations older than you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's already very much happening. I think a large part of why we're seeing such an enormous burgeoning of the anti-aging industry, in other words, the purveying of products that purport to be effective against aging, but in general are not. The reason we have that is precisely because these people don't seriously unhappy about going through life the way their forefathers did and just putting up with the idea of aging. But the reason I say yes and no is because there is still an enormously deep-seated fear that the whole thing is quixotic and that we'll never actually do anything about aging, or at least not nearly in time for the baby boomer generation. And, of course, that always translates into apprehension, fear of getting one's hopes up and having them dashed. So there is, I would say, a rather cowardly tendency among nearly everybody, actually, to keep one's emotional distance from this problem. To really, accept superficially that it's something that one wants to do, but to really, try one's best to treat it as entertainment and and to avoid getting too emotionally involved with it. And I think that's a large part of why I've always found it quite difficult to get the media to present my work in the way that I'd like. There's always a very strong tendency to focus on, to use words like immortality and living forever, and to focus on the on the life extension aspect rather than the health aspect, and generally to be a bit frivolous about the whole thing. And I feel that that's not because the media are doing anything malicious. It's just that that's what they know is going to sell. They know that the listeners and the viewers and the readers are interested mainly in being informed without being made uncomfortable by being forced to actually take this prospect seriously. And in a way, I think that's okay, because as time goes on and as the science moves forward, it's going to mean that these people have at least been primed to shift their priorities and their thinking from a completely fatalist mode into a determined mode to actually go on and do something. It is a bit frustrating at the moment, though, because, of course, what it so often translates into is utterly irrational opposition to the effort to defeat aging, born of just knee-jerk reactions of various sorts that are just ways to help people to put it out of their minds.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned the emotional distance. There was this piece done on you on BBC, it was a couple years ago now, that had some good stuff and I thought was really unfair in some ways, but the crux of the argument that the guy seemed to be making, between the lines, he didn't come right out and say it, but between the lines, was that this whole thing is invalid because you're emotionally invested, right? And I couldn't help but think, why wouldn't you be emotionally invested in this? What is wrong with wanting to end this? Why would an emotional involvement in that be a bad thing? It seemed like as attention to this increases, that we'll probably be hearing a lot more of that kind of thing, and it raises a kind of a sensitive issue. So I don't want to hit this too hard, but do you think that your public persona, because you have a very distinctive look, we'll put it that way, without saying any more than that, do you have a kind of a crackpot vibe, I guess, that people are responding to, or is it actually, do you think, benefiting the effort by the fact that you kind of stand out a little bit?
Yeah, this is a question that I really don't have a good answer to any more than I ever have. It's something that comes up all the time, of course. Different people give me different advice. It's just really hard to know. I mean, I think at one level, I think it's clear that both of the things you say are true. On the one hand, some people use it as an excuse to dismiss me. And on the other hand, it works in my favor because it's a sort of trademark. It's a sort of it demonstrates the sort of person I am in some ways. For example, it's very important for me not to for me to be very distinctly separate from the anti-aging industry, so that I'm not accused of being in this group for personal financial gain or anything, and looking rather, if you like, aggressively unmaterialistic is a very good way of doing that. And of course, I look like an academic and so on. So I think it very much does work both ways. But at this point, I think the balance of my experience over the past several years, when I've been having a reasonably high profile in this, is that I would say I'm probably getting it about right. It's sort of the combination between what I say being down to earth and how I look being a bit distinctive seems to be about right.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. Well, we like you the way you are. I'll tell you that much.
Thank you.
Stephen, did you have any additional questions for Aubrey? I see we're getting very close to our time.
I was basically going to ask the same question, but apologize in advance for it being a rude question because, I believe that you may offer your SIN program may offer us all additional lifespan. It would seem to be a very unkind thing to ask, but I was going to ask it as well. I guess that's about it, Phil.
Okay, well, before we conclude, just very briefly, we mentioned two organizations in the introduction. One is the M Prize, the Methuselah Mouse Prize, and the other is the SENS Foundation. I'm sure that listeners who would like to become involved in helping to make this happen would like to know how they can participate in that. So can you tell us a little bit about those two organizations?
Yeah, certainly. So the prize is being administered, as it always has been, by the Methuselah Foundation and foundation.org. And the research, the direct funding of research that I've always been mainly involved with is now being administered by the SENS Foundation, which is a new organization, a U.S. charity, just like the Methuselah Foundation, that was set up just 3 months ago. And all of the research activities that the Methuselah Foundation used to be performing have now been divested to the new foundation, the SENS Foundation. This has happened because we have come to the conclusion that the two activities, with pride on the one hand and research on the other hand, are just really very different in terms of both the internal organizational structure and the types of people and the types of skills that need to be involved, and also in terms of the outreach side of things, in terms of how we promote them. I think it's fair to say that the prize is a sort of populist venture. It's really a public relations exercise, and it's best promoted with a rather glitzy approach, whereas the research funding side of things is best promoted by making sure that everyone appreciates that the foundation is very much a mature organization with disinterested governance and a management that's got a lot of experience in the non-profit world and all that sort of thing. So at two foundations, we think the whole thing is going to work more effectively. We think we're going to be more attractive to potential donors, both large and small. And we generally think it's going to be best for the mission this way. So I now no longer have any affiliation with the Methuselah Foundation. I work solely as the chief science officer of the SENS Foundation. And our website is sense.org, not surprisingly. You can go there now and find out all about us. And, of course, you can donate money on the website, same as you ever could at the Methuselah Foundation. The website is actually a bit embryonic right now. It's in the process of being turned into something altogether better looking. So if you go and have a look at it now, then please go and have a look at it again in a week or two. But you can give us money whenever you like.
Anytime, yeah. Whatever stage the website development is at, the money will be accepted. We'll be sure and provide a link to sends.org, and of course we have links to the M Prize. So for those listening, if you're interested in helping to make this happen, check it out at sends.org. Well, Aubrey, the time has of course just flown by. It's wonderful catching up with you, and we wish you all the best of success. Thank you very much for being with us.
All right. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Okay, well, that just about takes us to the end of our program, unfortunately. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We've been talking with first Dr. Terry Grossman and then Dr. Aubrey de Grey about the possibility of extending human life. We'll be back on next Tuesday evening with a panel to talk about nanotechnology. But before we go, Stephen, what have we got lined up music-wise this evening?
The song is Carry On, and the artist is Mao Otayek.
Okay, I'm not going to try to repeat the artist, but the song's called Carry On. So very, very good thematic song. We're all going to try to carry on, or as we like to say, until next time, live to see it.
takes a lot of living to make a legend. And it takes a lot of pain just to live. But if you refuse to turn away and face the face that faces you, believe in what you do, and then your day will come to prove your faith to everyone. Don't you carry on. Can tired of living.